From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Battle of the Bulge. After nearly 6 months of fighting from the beaches of Normandy, by early December 1944, the Allies' front line stretched for 600 miles from the North Sea coast to the borders of Switzerland. The Scheldt estuary had finally been cleared, allowing the port of Antwerp to be opened and to start to ease their supply problems. With one of the coldest winters on record taking hold and Christmas approaching, many of the frontline troops probably expected a respite for at least a few weeks. What they didn't expect was for more than 400,000 German troops to come smashing through the Ardennes on a mission to recapture Antwerp and split the Allied forces in two. Why was the Battle of the Bulge such a surprise? Was it Allied complacency or German ingenuity? In this It Happened Here episode, using contemporary archival documents, Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheatham, will try to answer those questions. Special thanks to Mr. Ben Thompson for playing the role of our intelligence officer.
This is Bletchley Park. It Happened Here.
Our last It Happened Here episode looked at Operation Market Garden. Can you tell us what the situation was by sort of autumn winter time in 1944?
After Market Garden, really the front has largely stalled. The Allies are stuck against the German border. There isn't much prospect of them actually being able to enter Germany before 1945. But there are several operations in that period to sort of improve the position that they're in. The British and Canadians in the north, in Holland, clear the Scheldt estuary. We talked last episode about the port of Antwerp, which was captured intact, but it couldn't be used because the Germans controlled the access to the sea. That was one alternative to Market Garden. It's only on the 28th of November that the port is finally open to traffic, and that relieves a lot of the supply difficulties the Allies were having in the autumn. And there was fierce fighting around the Scheldt estuary and the island of Walcheren in Holland, which the Germans defended quite tenaciously. A bit further south, the American forces come up against what they and the British called the Siegfried Line, but what the Germans called the West Wall, which is a line of fortifications which protect the German border, sort of tank traps, bunkers, roadblocks. It's not a continuous line of trenches or anything like that, but it's a tough obstacle to get through, and it uses the terrain very effectively to defend the main routes by which Allied troops have to advance. So the US actually do launch an attack on the West Wall around the city of Aachen, which takes most of October. It's the westernmost German city and it's the first German city to be captured on the 21st of October. So the Americans do get there in the end, but it's a tough fight and they have to besiege the city for almost a month and there's fierce street fighting. That takes a lot of the momentum out of their operations. They follow that up with an attack in the Hürtgen Forest, which is probably, you know, even more of a slog. The hope is this will give them a good staging ground to launch an attack further into Germany in the direction of Cologne. And they also want to capture several dams which are in the high ground of the Hürtgen Forest, because if the Germans release the water from these dams, they can flood the valley below and block the line of advance. But that's very tough terrain. It's heavily forested, very few roads. It turns into a muddy morass with the passage of troops in the autumn. The Americans make relatively little progress. They take something like 33,000 casualties trying to clear this forest, and the battle there is still underway at the end of the year.
Two seaborne attacks are launched against the Nazis' last remaining Scheldt strong points. From Ostend, British commandos, supported by the full might of the Navy, thrust toward the western approaches of Walcheren Island. Meanwhile, on the south bank of the Scheldt, at the port of Breskens, troops under the command of the 1st Canadian Army massed to support the attack already underway across the estuary. Across the Scheldt, armored scout cars are the vanguard of advance west across the South Beveland Peninsula. Continuously harrying the stubbornly fighting enemy, valuable ground is gained in the race to free the approaches to the great harbor of Antwerp. Though the battle for the Scheldt moved into its final phase. Once cleared, and when the first freighter sailed into Antwerp, men of the 1st Canadian Army will have attained the most important objective since D-Day.
8 of us were suddenly chosen and told we were going to be sent on a special mission. Again, we were told it's top secret, we can't talk to anyone about it. And I was sent to Belgium, to Malines, or Mechelen in Flemish. I think it was somewhere near the beginning of December, after having probably about a week's training, we were told that we were going to track the V2s that were now landing on Antwerp. And why were they so important? Because we got them out of that area before they were able to do too much damage and destroy the facilities. Antwerp was the first clean port we had. So the Germans then were sending V2s up onto Antwerp to hopefully to damage the docks. In actual fact, they were not sending the V2s up in the same way as they did initially. Because they were in retreat, these V2s had to be sent up from a lorry with a trailer. And the lorry and the trailer would move away from their supply base, hide in a wood or by the coast or even in car parks. It took about 4 minutes to land. Now, it took them 25 minutes from the moment of launch before those lorries could move on. They had so much high-octane fuel aboard that was left that had to be got rid of. The attendant lorries had to all move away. We were only 15 kilometres away from Antwerp. What we had to do, once we got the fall of shot, which naturally was after they'd landed, we would then marry it with the one point of the trajectory that was picked up by the mobile radars that were on the continent by then. Using a slide rule, we would extrapolate the curve backwards to the launch site. So we had 4 minutes they landed, 6 minutes for us. We'd move it on to intelligence, which might take another 2 minutes. They would check up with the sound from the Royal Army Service Corps, I think it was, and they would send sound positions in, and those two bits of information would then give, with our information, the launching. And we had mosquitoes in the air permanently in the areas where they might be operating, and the nearest section of mosquitoes would bomb the lorries. And by the end of February, beginning of March 1945, all those lorries were annihilated and the Germans' manufacturing never managed to catch up with it. And by that time, they were launching them from, Hanover District, Rotterdam and farther north, that sort of area. We went on right to VE Day, plotting them.
What was the German plan here? What were they doing to counter these advances?
The Allies expected that the Germans would hunker down, try and slow them where possible, but wouldn't do anything too risky because they just didn't have the resources or the troops, especially the armour and vehicles and fuel to launch a major counteroffensive. But that's not reckoning with the sort of level of insanity we're talking about in the German high command at this stage of the war. Hitler is very much in control after the July plot, which saw him almost assassinated, narrowly escaped being killed. He's very much in control of the German high command, and he has a plan to recover the situation in the West, and that is by launching a counteroffensive. The planning for this starts actually around September, so it's been quite a long time in the works, and the idea is that the German forces will attack, they will recapture Antwerp, they will, you know, put the Allies back into that terrible supply situation they were in earlier in the year. They will hopefully exploit weaknesses in the Anglo-American alliance and hopefully cause that to collapse. Either push the Allies back into the sea or achieve a peaceful settlement in the West, and that will allow them to turn their attention to the East and buy time against the Russians. The Eastern Front is obviously the Germans' main concern throughout most of the war. If they can buy time against the Russians, they can rebuild their forces, they can bring new weapons into the field, and hopefully that gives them a chance to turn the tide in the East as well. This is very unrealistic, the whole plan, but realism isn't what Hitler is interested in at this stage. He's interested in sort of grand gestures almost, and he's becoming more and more detached from reality. Unfortunately for the Allies, this is the kind of opponent they're having to deal with. They're not dealing with a rational opponent who is going to, you know, do the sensible thing to keep his forces in the field for the longest possible time. The reason the Germans are planning to attack in the Ardennes is partly irrational as well. It had been the site of German successes in 1914 and again in 1940. So there was almost a superstitious belief that if they attack in the Ardennes, this is where German troops would always win. Famously, it's a position which the Allies believed was poor offensive terrain. It's often said that it had relatively few roads. It had quite a good road network. The problem is that the roads were split up by quite dense forest, a bit like the Hürgen Forest. So cross-country movement was difficult, and the roads tended to join together in these crossroads towns, which were quite easy positions to defend. So there wasn't really the open ground for a major offensive to look viable. That didn't stop the Germans planning, though. The Americans believed this area was a pretty safe part of the front, quiet, that very little would happen, and it was an ideal place to introduce troops to the front line, troops that had just arrived in Europe or had seen heavy combat and were basically recovering from that. And in the end, they launched their attack against these relatively weak troops, relatively thinly spread, so not the toughest opposition for the Germans.
You use the word insanity to describe Hitler's thinking. It sounds as if his plans were very unpredictable. What did the Allies actually know? Had they predicted any of this at all?
I think with the Ardennes, we see a big intelligence problem with the Allied command, and it's much bigger than Bletchley's role. But you can't really understand the situation unless you look a bit more widely. We know in hindsight this offensive was going to take place. In late 1944, obviously, they didn't. That makes all the difference because there were many, many indications of what was going to happen, and we can easily pick those out and say that these showed us what was going to happen. But that's only with the benefit of hindsight. Virtually all of the intelligence chiefs involved in the various Allied armies or at the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Armies, Scheif, predicted aspects of the offensive. And some of them were quite worried about the situation in the Ardennes. They thought it was too badly defended. The clearest example is Major General Kenneth Strong, who was G2, so Chief Intelligence Officer at Scheif. And he actually went to General Bradley in early December with his concerns about the Ardennes and about the growing possibility of a German offensive. Bradley seems to have brushed off his concerns. And he actually said, let them come. He'd be quite happy for the Germans to attack because it would put them in a vulnerable position and allow him to do more damage to them compared to them defending behind the Siegfried Line.
And was this a feeling that was repeated again throughout various commanders on the Allied force, or was this just a lone example of Bradley's?
As I say, that's the clearest example, but there are suspicions in many quarters. These never quite turn into a strong conviction that the Allies know what's going to happen. And obviously, there is a major gulf between acknowledging that something is possible and believing that it's probable and it's going to happen. And it's that step which the Allies never quite take before the Ardennes offensive. One of the other major American commanders, Patton, did actually prepare plans for an offensive in the Ardennes. He was poised to attack in Alsace, but he made sure that if the Germans did try and pull anything off further north, that the plans were in place for his troops to basically pivot northwards and react to it. But again, that was a contingency plan. It didn't really show that he expected it to happen.
And was it one plan among many of varying contingency plans that might be the result of whatever the Germans' next move was?
Exactly. They were trying to second guess, and there were a lot of possibilities. A major problem, as I say, is that the Allies really think that they're facing a rational enemy, a more rational enemy than they're actually facing. So when they see indications of what the Germans are doing, they tend to put these down to what they would do in the German situation. When they see the build-up of armoured troops in particular, they think the Germans are amassing an armoured reserve, which is going to react to an Allied attack, because that would be the sensible thing to do. And it's the same when they see a build-up of air forces. They think the Germans might launch an air attack, but in a sort of defensive way to support a defensive stance, or they might actually be amassing planes to intervene in the strategic bomber offensive, because obviously there's a large amount of bombing of German industry going on at this stage of the war. The strategic bombing offensive is building up to a crescendo.
Flying fortresses, manned by United States Army Air Force crews, bound for Germany in broad daylight. The RAF pounding the continent by night, the Americans by day. A combined Allied air offensive that is smashing Nazi industrial centers one by one. Bound for home. Somewhere in England, Allied ground crews anxiously await the return of the raiders. Although tails were riddled and landing gear shot away, not one bomber failed to return.
So they tend to put these indications that they do see down to German defensive plans or plans for a counter-offensive rather than an outright offensive into Allied territory.
You said that various commanders predicted elements of this offensive, but they must have had some kind of evidence that led them to those conclusions. What kind of things were they finding out about that might have led them to believe that actually it was an attack rather than defensive measures?
Well, I can list some of the things that they did know about. They knew the Germans were building up an armoured reserve. They could see there were train movements in that region. The problem is the train movements, they tended to put them down to troops moving north and south rather than troops moving into the Ardennes. They could explain it away in that way. The Allies have evidence that the Germans are low on fuel and that frontline units especially are really short on fuel. And they put this down to the Germans running out of fuel in a general way. But actually, the Germans are running out of fuel in their frontline units because they're hoarding it for the counteroffensive. So that's a really good example of a piece of the intelligence picture which is open to interpretation. And the Allies interpret it in a rosy way because they are looking for evidence that the German state is on its last legs and they think they found it. They knew there were lorries being reallocated from Italy to Western Germany. They knew that the Luftwaffe were building up their forces. They knew there were German requests for air cover and reconnaissance in the region, and especially those missions involved the new Arado 234 jets, which were cutting edge and really an indication that the Germans were focusing their best forces on the Ardennes. There were frontline reports of enemy activity and build-up. There were sightings of bridging material and assault boats from Belgian refugees. So in hindsight, put all together, that seems like pretty clear evidence. But at the time, nobody quite joined the dots.
So it was a lack of ability to interpret what was being seen here that led to the lack of preparation.
Yeah. So interpretation is the word. We saw it with Market Garden, that interpretation was incredibly difficult, where you could see the panzer divisions, or at least their headquarters, were in the area. But you don't know necessarily how strong they are and what they're intending to do and how much of a threat they actually pose. So you have exactly the same problems later in the year, where all these indications were completely open to interpretation and it was very ambiguous what they actually meant.
The intelligence picture should have helped with interpreting what events were taking place. Can you say that the Germans could take any credit for the lack of understanding that the Allies had?
Yeah, so the Germans, to their credit, do several things which make it harder for the Allies to work out what's going on. The overall situation, the sort of operational situation, is important because the shorter front reduced the German supply problems. It meant that they didn't have to move so many troops around, so there were fewer opportunities for the Allies to spot what they were doing. They were using landlines more often. Obviously, within the borders of Germany, that's quite easy. And there was obviously no information from agents or very little information from agents or no ability to ask the resistance what was happening because there was no resistance in Germany. The Germans actually enacted wireless silence among the units who were preparing to attack, and this made it very tricky to work out what they were doing. It's not that they were invisible, but it reduced what the Allies could work out. For example, at Bletchley Park, Sixter, which is the section that does traffic analysis, it spots that there is a new German wireless network near the Ardennes. And it's able to do this because in order to maintain the network, the German operators have to do a certain amount of back and forth chatter to make sure they're all on the same frequencies and they're still responding to each other. And to make sure when the time comes, the network can spring into life and start carrying operational traffic. So even though they're in wireless silence, I say that in quotation marks, there is a certain amount of traffic. But the Germans are keeping their transmissions very, very short. So the Allies can't do direction finding. So they can't work out exactly where those stations are. They can't work out exactly where that formation is based, although they know it's somewhere on the Western Front, of course. And they can't know exactly what formation it is and what it's planning to do. They're not being able to intercept sort of operational messages, which Hook 6 can then decrypt and derive intelligence from.
And keeping those transmissions short is a deliberate move to prevent direction finding from being able to discover the location.
Because the Germans, even though the Germans don't know that the Allies are reading Enigma, they know that traffic analysis is possible. They do it themselves. So they don't want a big spike in radio traffic from one location to show that anything is untoward. And the Germans actually carry out deception measures as well, a bit like the Allies are famous for doing it before D-Day. But the Germans, as they're moving troops into position, rename units in a confusing way, basically. So 6th Panzer Army, one of the two Panzer Armies that would take part in the offensive, was called Rest and Refitting Staff 16. So if you saw Rest and Refitting Staff 16 come up in a message, you wouldn't necessarily pay it too much attention. And in a way, that's almost as much to hide the situation from the Germans as it is to hide it from the Allies, because Hitler doesn't trust his army anymore, and he doesn't trust that there aren't people within German ranks who wouldn't give the game away, so he wants to conceal it from them as well.
Renewed First Army activity on the Hütgen Forest Front, through which our troops have been fighting since crossing the German frontier in September. Fighting in this wooded terrain is southeast of Aachen, where a new Allied drive begins on 16th November. The three American armies of the 12th Army Group have now taken approximately 400,000 prisoners since D-Day.
And the other thing I should mention is German staff work. They are very effective at moving troops around. The German military famously effective at this sort of stuff. What the Germans managed to do is transport divisions from all the way on the other side of the Rhine, so some 100 miles into Germany, all the way to the front without the Allies seeing it. They do it overnight, using trains, of course, and they organise things in such a way that they can bring a division in and have it unloaded and undercover in the battle zone, and the trains returned onto the other side of the Rhine by morning before the Allies have a chance to send an air reconnaissance plane over and actually spot what's going on. So actually very precise and well-executed planning is going into the offensive as well. So you've got to give the Germans credit for that.
And it sounds like there's a variety of tactics here. As you say, deception, stealth, speed, efficiency, various ways of using their messaging to avoid direction-finding techniques. Was Bletchley Park onto this? Was there someone at Bletchley Park saying, if only I was being listened to, because the messages that were being intercepted were clearly showing this? Or was Bletchley Park as much in the dark as everyone else?
Bletchley Park, like the rest of the Allied intelligence apparatus, never seems to join the dots. Although, of course, there is a lot there in SIGINT, even in spite of, you know, the German radio silence and all of the other things. There is a lot of evidence out there, but it's not brought together into a coherent whole, and they don't predict the offensive at the end of the day. Like Market Garden, there's a problem of interpretation, but we've got an additional problem that emerges later in the year as well, which is that the commanders are basically becoming over-dependent on Ultra, and it's becoming a victim of its own success in some ways. They're so used to having this fantastic source of really detailed, in-depth information and masses of it that they almost start to believe that if it isn't in Ultra, it can't be true. This is something that Frederick Winterbottom says in his book, which obviously was the book which revealed the Ultra secret to the world in 1974. He said, Ultra had been so helpful during the previous year that some intelligence staffs had begun to rely on it almost entirely. So Ultra didn't show strong evidence for the Ardennes offensive. And in the views of certain individuals in the Allied intelligence services, that meant the Ardennes counteroffensive couldn't happen. They are interpreting that gap in the intelligence picture as negative intelligence, whereas really it's a gap in their knowledge. And instead of trying to fill it, they just assume there's nothing there.
That's an overconfidence in Ultra. You think that's kind of a complacency about what is being provided by Ultra?
Absolutely. And I think we have quite strong evidence for this. We have some documents in our archives about how the air intelligence picture was built up. And this goes into some of the detail about the administration of how the Joint Intelligence Staff and the Joint Intelligence Committee, which was a committee designed to bring together intelligence from all three armed services, how that worked. And these post-war histories actually say that the Joint Intelligence Staff were sometimes apt to forget that Ultra was never complete. The Joint Intelligence Staff were too ready to deduce a great deal from very little. Conversely, they were sometimes apt to argue against a hunch or even against a logically supportable theory, because it is not in Ultra, ergo it cannot be. And they talk about the Ardennes specifically, and they say there were strong indications from air intelligence that the Germans planned to launch a serious counteroffensive in the early winter of 1944, but the absolute lack of comparable evidence from Ultra Army and Navy intelligence resulted in the Joint Intelligence Committee deciding on balance that no such offensive need be expected. Similar claims come from Bill Williams, who was Montgomery's intelligence chief at 21st Army Group. And he said, by providing the answer to an intelligence officer's prayer, it was liable to save the recipient from doing intelligence. Instead of being the best, it tended to become the only source. And again, he talks about the Ardennes specifically. He says, we argued the point about the Ardennes in early December and decided wrongly. We gave a lead, but the wrong lead. The error didn't lie with the park, but rather in our attitude to the park. So it seems unfair to accuse these people of being a bit intellectually naive and taking, you know, a gap in the evidence as negative evidence. But there is evidence that that's what happened. You know, we have it in their reports and in their histories and in their accounts of their work.
And this is an attitude more widespread than just here with the Ardennes offensive. It was something right across ministries and the way that they were receiving Ultra intelligence. Their general attitude was like this.
Yeah, I think by this point in the war, they'd basically become spoiled. And that clouded their judgment somewhat and made them overestimate the value of the source and overestimate how comprehensive it was.
In Europe, the Americans have crossed the Saar River. Further north, they've captured Linnik, and the British have opened an attack on Venlo on the Maas. Now, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Bill Downs reporting.
10,000 men from all over Britain paraded the streets of London today to mark the passing of an era in this war against Germany. Representative Home Guard units from every part of the United Kingdom paraded before the King for the last time in an official stand-down ceremony which in effect disbands Britain's civilian army. They marched well. Every man was well equipped. It was a far cry from the days of 1940 after Dunkirk when the government issued a call to arms for all civilians. The significant thing about this farewell ceremony is that while this nation is disbanding its civilian army, the Nazis are just organizing theirs. But as late as last week when I was on the Geilenkirchen front, I looked at the German civilians who were supposed to make up Hitler's Volkssturm civilian army. They do not have the look of the British Home Guard. It's hard to explain, but in the lean, wrinkled faces of the men who marched for the last time today, there was something far different from what you can see in the face of a German. It's the look of a man who knows he's right, as opposed to the look of a man caught thieving.
Really, was there absolutely no evidence at all? Was there no department, nobody at Bletchley Park that was trying to make the point that this offensive was being prepared for, that these plans were being made?
Well, just like at the commands, there were people who had suspicions and who identified that something was going on behind the German lines. But exactly the same, the dots are never joined and there's never a firm conviction that emerges that a counteroffensive is going to happen. There's a report from Air Section from the 5th of November 1944, which talks about a German project for the first days of November. But they couldn't decide whether this project was in support of ground forces or an independent air force operation. They couldn't decide when it might take place. They couldn't decide exactly what the target would be. All they could see was that German air forces were building up. By the time the offensive actually lands, it's more than a month later. And another factor, which is really easy to forget in hindsight, is that we see all this intelligence in one go. But for the intelligence staff at the time, it's emerging over the space of weeks and months. And that means that they might spot an interesting piece of intelligence in September or October. But by the time it becomes significant in December, they've frankly forgotten about it. They've got too much to handle. So maintaining a good overview of all the information you have over such a long period of time is actually really difficult. So it's hard to see how else you could organise it to overcome a problem like that.
This was something that was spotted through Air Section.
Yes.
Were there ways of cross-referencing information like that in the way that you were saying, to be able to build up a more confident picture with other departments? Were the different sections amassing the information in one place?
Yeah, so Air Section does talk to the people doing Enigma work. Air Section doesn't do its own Enigma work. Our Air Force Enigma is dealt with in Hut 6 and Hut 3. But they do talk to each other through a section called SALU, named after Saltmarsh and Lucas, who set it up. But the point of the section was to liaise between the Enigma parties and Air Section, doing their sort of lower grade air-to-ground codes and medium grade ciphers. But it's no one individual's responsibility to bring this all together. It's not possible for one individual to do it because there's too much of it. So you rely on multiple individuals coming to sensible conclusions and then all talking to each other. And that's very difficult to orchestrate because many of them do uncover interesting pieces of evidence, and they don't ever come together and talk to each other and all come to a conclusion about what it all means. Again, it's really hard to see how you would overcome a problem like that. It's just too big and complex a problem, I think, the intelligence picture at this stage. There are some clear near misses, though, from the Bletchley Park point of view. I talked about the German wireless network, which Sixter identified. We have an account of this from Neil Webster, who was in Sixter and specifically in the fusion room, which was the link between Sixter and Hut 6. And he talks about how his section actually got round the table and talked about whether they should raise the alarm about the Germans planning some counterattack, counteroffensive, whatever. But their evidence was too patchy, and they decided, in the end, they wouldn't inform Hut 3 or take it any further. He says, for the rather poor reason that it would make a big fuss and we would look so silly if we were wrong.
Goodness.
And there's a similar situation in Hut 3 itself, actually, as well. We have to remember what Hut 3's role is at this time. Its job isn't to do all the intelligence work. Its job is to read Enigma messages and to explain the significance of those messages and then pass them on. They do bring in broader intelligence sources, but they use those to illuminate what the Enigma means or what the Ultra means. it's not their job to come to the final conclusions. That is the job of the commands, and specifically SHAFE and in London, the Joint Intelligence Committee at the ministries. And we have a description from Neil Webster again about Humphrey. He says, Humphrey was shy of going beyond its job of amending and explaining German messages. Drawing broad conclusions was for the intelligence staff at SHAFE, who had information from all sources. So Humphrey didn't tell SHAFE of the conclusions they were beginning to draw, and SHAFE did not draw any conclusions. So you have a bit of a tension there. Bletchley Park has inklings of what's happening, but they don't really have the authority or the confidence to really bang the drum about it. Because at the end of the day, it's not their job to do that. It's only their job to pass on the decrypted messages. This is something that Eric Jones, in charge of Humphrey, tries to put right after the fact. And he issues a memo where he identifies this problem.
Hut 3 memo, 2nd of January, 1945. We have nothing to reproach ourselves for in our dissemination of factual intelligence on the recent German offensive. But, in the field of appreciating that intelligence, a field in which we are limited to offering our ideas to ministries without ever having been charged with this as a responsibility, we made one mistake. We held views which differed from those of heads of sections in ministries on a matter of great strategic importance to our recipients, and took no steps to bring them to bear at a higher level. Signed, Eric Jones.
So Eric Jones doesn't want another situation where Humphrey has an idea of what's going to happen and doesn't raise it to a higher level. But, you know, it's too little too late because the Ardennes offensive has already happened. As it turns out, that's going to be the last major German offensive.
So while they learned the lessons came too late.
Yeah. Bletchley has the same problem that the commands have. There isn't any outright evidence of what's going to happen. It's all open to interpretation. The only outright statements that a German attack is planned actually come from Japanese sources, because just like before D-Day, Bletchley Park are finding out a lot about what the Germans are doing from the Japanese.
Were the British the people who were doing the attacks on the Japanese traffic, or?
Well, it's a joint effort with the Americans. The Americans are doing most of the work, but the British are doing their part as well. So it's an international effort. The Germans tell the Japanese that they're planning an offensive. And this goes back to Tokyo, and, you know, on the way to Tokyo, it comes to the Allies. The problem is that Bletchley Park had long ago learned that the Germans didn't always tell the Japanese exactly what they meant. They tend to exaggerate. The Japanese tend to be quite credulous of whatever the Germans tell them and to report it very loyally. So Bletchley certainly reads these messages and doesn't think too much of them, because it's just another outrageous, unrealistic claim from the Germans, surely. And the Japanese are foolish for swallowing it.
But in this situation, it was actually quite an accurate report.
Yeah, in the end, in hindsight, you can see that it was an indication of what was going to happen. At the end of the day, the commands think they're getting a good service from Bletchley Park. They are generally learning a lot. We have a letter in the archives from Kenneth Strong, intelligence chief at SHAFE, to Edward Travis, who's in charge of Bletchley Park at this point, thanking him for his support, thanking him and his staff for all the hard work they've done supporting the commanders in the field and for all the fantastic intelligence that they're producing, and long may it continue. Ironically, this letter is sent on the 16th of December, the very day of the attack, just hours before Kenneth Strong finds out that the Germans have launched this enormous counteroffensive in the Ardennes.
Das ist der Königstiger. Diese Waffen schmiedet pausenlos das schaffende Deutschland für den letzten entscheidenden Kampf.
Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, surprise advance. After exploratory thrusts on 16th December, the campaign gains full momentum through the early morning of the next day. German High Command has committed at least 20 full-strength divisions to the winter offensive. Reports from our command reveal that the Germans are employed captured Sherman tanks and American jeeps and trucks. Also, specially assigned Nazis wearing U.S. uniforms are discovered infiltrating behind our lines. U.S. troops on the southern wing of the American First Army are forced back along the fluid front as the carefully planned offensive achieves initial surprise. On 17th December, infantry units move out of Wertsfeld, Belgium toward Elsenborn. Later, regrouped American forces are to hold off a whole Panzer army in the Elsenborn salient, south of Monschau.
During the night, the town had been bombed a little, strafed a little, and a siren had wakened us to give warning of paratroop activities. In the morning, there was a rumor that German tanks were just over the hill. Armed patrols went out on the roads. Trees were felled as roadblocks. Then the order that everyone hoped would never come came. We had to move out quickly. Somehow the news spread around the little Belgian border town, and the people came out to see the leave-taking. Some of the troops had been there for 3 months. Many had made friends. There was handshaking and many questions. How near were the Germans? Did we think they'd come to their town again? Was it true the German tanks were just over the hill? There were awkward silences. The GIs couldn't answer that question. A truck driver tying the tarpaulin over his loaded truck swore quietly and said, "I never thought this would happen to us."
So tell us about the attack. What happened?
The Germans achieved complete surprise, even though some of the Allied intelligence officers had their inklings. This obviously doesn't filter down to battalion company level commanders who are on the front lines. Early on, the situation is very unclear. The weather is bad. The Germans have intentionally picked a day with bad weather because they want to make sure that Allied air support's grounded. So that plays into their hands perfectly. And it also means that Allied commanders aren't really able to find out what's happening on the front lines very easily. The German bombardment, which opens their offensive, breaks a lot of telephone wires. So a lot of frontline troops are actually cut off from communication very, very quickly. And they're hit by strong, well-equipped German forces who have also achieved quite a major superiority of force and numerical superiority. Through that staff work, which has allowed them to move really strong forces into position. So they hit these relatively weak American troops. There isn't much chance of stopping them for the Americans, but the Americans do fight very tenaciously. If there are any myths of mass surrenders and of the American position collapsing, I think that's highly unfair because the troops who are tasked with trying to stop the Germans do their very best in very straitened circumstances. A lot of American forces do retreat, but we're talking about medical units, anti-air units, artillery units that really shouldn't be anywhere near the front line anyway. It's important that they get away from the Germans so they can set up stronger defence further back.
So you wouldn't say they were overwhelmed. It was the German advantage of total surprise and superior force and the difficult conditions. The Americans still weren't necessarily overwhelmed. There was this strong resistance to the attack when it first happened.
I would say they were overwhelmed.
Okay.
They weren't defeated in a moral sense. They just did not have the numbers or the firepower to deal with what the Germans were throwing at them. So it's very understandable that they didn't manage to hold them off. However, they delayed the German timetable pretty quickly. The Germans are relying on covering a lot of ground very quickly, capturing those key crossroads towns, not being forced off-road. And they're also planning on capturing Allied supplies, especially fuel, because, you know, they don't have the fuel to keep their tanks rolling all the way to Antwerp. They're going to have to scavenge for what they need. And this means as soon as the offensive starts going off schedule, it very quickly spirals into a situation that Germans can't possibly recover. Within a few days, it's quite clear that they're never going to make it to Antwerp. And the American defences start to strengthen in several key places. In the north of the salient that forms, you have the Elsenborn Ridge, and that's defended very tenaciously by scratch American forces. And they use massed artillery bombardments to hold the Germans off and force them to seek other routes. And they also defend the towns of Sanvif and Bastogne as well. Sanvif is eventually captured. Bastogne famously is held by the US airborne troops who are quickly trucked in before it gets surrounded and it's besieged for several days, but it never falls to the Germans. So without being able to capture those sorts of crossroads, the Germans are forced off-road. That slows them down. In the end, they make it about 50 miles into Allied lines over about 10 days, but they're nowhere near getting to Antwerp.
At Bastogne, the Liège-Arlon highway meets 6 other roads. Our forces are regrouped to hold these vital approaches to the Meuse. Already an historic defense is being put up at Bastogne by troops which include the 101st Airborne Division. The U.S. command had given one order: hold Bastogne at all costs. To this end, the 4th Armored Division also moves up, and along with other units, makes sure that besieged Bastogne holds firm. Brigadier General McAuliffe, the 101st acting commander, answered the Nazi ultimatum to surrender the Bastogne garrison with a single word: nuts.
The Germans bombed Bastogne at night and strafed occasionally during the day. On the 22nd, the German commander, ridiculously enough, demanded surrender of the surrounding town. I just replied, nuts, for I knew that one word best expressed the feelings of the division. The wounded were wonderful. No words can describe their cheerful acceptance of a tough situation. On Christmas Day, the Germans launched their biggest attack with infantry and tanks in large numbers from the west of Bastogne and the rear of the position. Prisoners later told us that their officers had told them that Bastogne was to be a Christmas present for the Fuhrer. The Christmas present consisted of a number of hulks that lie in the center of the ground back of Bastogne now, destroyed by Americans and the infantry repulsed at the same time. On December 26, at 5 p.m., we made contact with friendly troops. Through it all, no one doubted for an instant that we would hold the town under any sort of attack the Germans could put on. The 101st Airborne Division has met and defeated the Germans in Normandy and Holland and will continue to do so whenever called upon.
Eventually, the Allies recover their position. Patton's troops pivot north as he planned and start to pressurise the salient to the south. To the north, there is a British role in this battle, even though it's predominantly an American battle. The American forces in the northern side, the 1st and 9th armies, are actually transferred to Montgomery's command. And that's a very sensible thing to do because they aren't really able to communicate with Bradley, whose headquarters is in the south. But it's a bit of a public relations disaster for Montgomery because he actually holds a press conference towards the end of the offensive in which he lavishes praise upon the Americans, but also he seems to take far too much credit for recovering the situation. And this is not something which goes down very well with Bradley. And this is probably the closest Montgomery comes to losing his command during the campaign. He's not popular to begin with, and then it seems like he's arrogantly taking credit for the Brits in a battle which is really one being fought by the Americans. The Battle of the Bulge, it's a very large battle. It's much larger than Market Garden. In the end, there's about a million US and German troops involved, if you top them up, about 100,000 British. Casualties are also significant, about 90,000 US casualties and 65,000 Germans. And obviously, it's winter, snowy conditions, bad weather, it's very, very cold. 17,000 US troops are hospitalized with frostbites. For a battle in Europe on the Western Front, it's a brutal battle. There are massacres, firstly by the Germans, by SS troops, famously at Malmedy. They capture about 100 American troops. And in the end, they're herded into a field and 84 of them are shot. A few manage to survive and eventually escape. There's also a smaller scale massacre of African-American troops elsewhere. And that leads to retaliations from the Americans as well, who eventually carry out reprisals on German troops. So it is an unpleasant and brutal battle. Bitter behavior on both sides.
To meet the German drive, General Eisenhower here at Supreme Headquarters resourcefully regroups his forces, giving Field Marshal Montgomery complete command over the entire northern sector. With Britain's famous Monty cleverly holding Rundstedt back in the north, his American counterpart, General Bradley, blocks the Nazis in the south.
According to latest bulletins from Europe, the Allies have stopped the German drive against the American First Army, at least temporarily. At the same time, American troops are driving against the southern flank of the German push and have smashed four dents into the Nazi wall. German Field Marshal von Rundstedt was able to start his counterattack against the American First Army because weather conditions had made it impossible for Allied air operations, keeping American and British planes on the ground. Of course, it is too early to evaluate the exact situation on the Western Front. Many people have wondered where the Nazis got the men and equipment to enable them to make such an all-out offensive. It was thought that Germany had reached the bottom of her manpower barrel and that her supplies and reserves were very limited. But now, that seems to have been the result of Nazi propaganda, something that the Nazis themselves led everyone to believe in order to create an overconfidence among the Allied leaders and people. American headquarters in Paris announced today that Major Glenn Miller, director of the American Army Air Force's band and a former popular orchestra leader in the United States, is missing on a flight from England to Paris. Miller left England on December 15th as a passenger aboard a plane. No trace of the plane has been found since. His Air Force band had been playing in Paris, but no member of the band was with him on the flight.
The very worst time, actually, was over that Christmas because the weather clamped down. And because of that, our aircraft couldn't go up. And in addition, it was the time of the Rundstedt offensive, which was destined to get to Antwerp. We were 10, 15 kilometres away. We were on the line of being captured. We didn't realise it at the time. We didn't think about it. We just got on with our job. That was a very vital thing because they were trying to cut the British troops north of that line from the American troops, which were entering in from the French border. And it would have been a disaster if it had not been successful, our repulse of that. So only a few months ago, looking at the map, I thought, well, of course we were on the line. Never occurred to me at the time. You know, you do a job and you don't think of the ramifications.
On the Western Front today, the Germans have failed in their latest efforts to close the relief corridor to the highway town of Bastogne. American troops have rolled back the enemy's spearhead, pointed at Sedan. They pushed it back 7 miles, and the front dispatch reports that Allied forces have taken the Belgian city of Rochefort. American and British planes have continued their attacks on German supply points, and 52 German fighters were shot down in air battles today. And now here in our New York studio, to discuss with us the situation on the Western Front, is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The German counterattacks against the Third Army's advanced elements in the Bastogne area have been beaten off. The Third Army is in full control of the Bastogne-Arlon Road and appears to be preparing to continue its advance northward, which was temporarily interrupted by the German counterblows. These blows appear to have been delivered in an attempt to clear the way for the escape of German elements to the westward of the main road, particularly in the Libremont and Saint-Hubert areas, elements whose supply lines have been cut or are threatened by the Third Army's push northward. On the west side of the German salient, the town of Rochefort has been recaptured by Allied forces. Otherwise, there is little change in the ground situation. But there is one very helpful change in the air. After 3 days of renewed mist and fog, this morning dawned cold and crystal clear, and Allied tactical air power was out in full force. This will not only give our airmen a new opportunity for attacking German ground forces, it will also give our commanders detailed information of the German dispositions, which have been hidden by the elements during 3 days of German withdrawals and regroupings. Von Rundstedt must now make up his mind whether to try again for greater gains or to withdraw inside the Siegfried defenses.
World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation. Tomorrow is the dawn of a new year. The year just ending has been one of accomplishment on the battlefronts and on the production fronts. Admiral wishes for you all a happy new year, a year that will see the triumph of peace and justice around the world, a year in which we must all repledge our wholehearted efforts to the jobs of making victory a reality.
As the battle goes on, Allied material superiority begins to be brought to bear. By the end of December, it's apparent the Germans really aren't advancing anymore. They're starting to retreat. But the classic Hitler reaction to this is to double down and gamble again. So he launches another attack. Firstly, an air attack called Operation Bodenplatte, which aims to wipe out the Allied air forces. And the Germans launch this mass bombing of Allied airfields on New Year's Day. And they destroy 465 Allied aircraft. But the problem is the Germans also lose 277 planes of their own and irreplaceable, experienced pilots. By this point, the Luftwaffe is falling apart. They're running out of planes, but it's also running out of people to fly them. And most pilots at this stage are very inexperienced, so the Germans really can't afford these sorts of losses. So that attack turns out to be really the last gasp of the Luftwaffe in the West, certainly. And it's a spent force for the rest of the war. There's also another German attack on the ground, Operation Nordwind, and this lands in Alsace, where Patton's forces have been pushing north, and it's an attempt to take them off guard and recapture ground there. This time, Ultra does give warning of the offensive. It's a sticky situation for a certain amount of time, but again, the Germans just simply don't have the forces to win out. And by throwing their troops into these sorts of attacks, they're really wasting them. They're not causing the sort of damage to the Allies, which they would if they stayed on the defensive.
So it sounds like the tide is turning at this point. Were the Germans able to maintain any kind of superiority, or did this lead to retreat?
The Germans try and hang on to what they've captured, to that salient that they've made in the Allied lines, and the Allies want to obviously recapture it to give them their foothold into Germany. So the fighting goes on in quite brutal fashion and in quite a grinding way all the way through to the end of January. But really, by the end of December, there's not really any chance of the Germans achieving their objectives or really changing the position in the West at all.
Increasing quantities of supplies freshly arrived from coastal ports are moved up in pace with accelerated activities all along the Ruhr River, Luxembourg, and Alsace fronts during the final stages of the Battle of the Bulge. Roads radiating out of Eupen, Belgium, and southward toward Malmedy and Stavelo are blanketed by 4 to 5 feet of snow. Shovel brigades strive to keep a lane clear, but high winds pile up new drifts. Tied up behind these snow removal forces are convoys stretching for 3 solid miles, trucks loaded with ammunition, mail, and food, and ambulances with litter cases from the front line. These adverse conditions consistently hampered operations flattening the bulge.
While all this activity was taking place, mid to late December, early January, what was happening back at Bletchley Park?
So at Bletchley Park, the recriminations are starting to fly a little bit. I think what we see is that Bletchley actually is quite introspective and quite willing to accept when mistakes have been made and to learn lessons. It's a sort of testament to the sort of modern, forward-looking attitude of the place. As soon as they realise that, you know, this intelligence has been missed, they very quickly get on the job to finding out why and what went wrong.
Top secret. AZ-2436, 31st of December, 1944. Dear O'Connor, I enclose a copy of the paper by Hut 3 on the indications of the German offensive of December 1944. This is for the personal information of General Bissell, Brigadier General Clark, and Colonel McCormack. I should be glad if you would see them and make it perfectly clear that this paper is BP's unofficial appreciation and should not be quoted to the War Office or Air Ministry, although, of course, copies have been circulated to the DMI and ACAS. Signed, E.W. Travis.
So Peter Calvacoresi and Frank Lucas, both of Hut 3, are tasked with putting together a sort of post-mortem of the intelligence that was available that indicated the Ardennes offensive and why it was missed.
Do you know if Eric Jones prompted them? Because it was, again, quite emblematic of Eric Jones's managerial style, where nowadays lessons learned and so on. Or was it like a Bletchley standard?
I'm not sure who actually gave the order. I know they give it to Menzies in the end. But the document in the archives, it has the Director General written on it, and then they've crossed out General. So that turns it into the Director, which is Travis.
Ah, okay.
But then the copy that's gone to Menzies, they've written General again.
Okay, so confusion reigns.
Yeah, I guess Travis and Menzies were both involved, but I don't have any evidence for that. I think what's really interesting about this report is that in a few weeks, in December 1944, they do probably a better job than any historian has since in summing up the sort of intelligence failure which happened at Bletchley Park. They managed to collate all the available evidence and come to some really sensible, I think fair, conclusions about what went wrong.
Indications of Ardennes counteroffensive, derived from ultramaterial by F.L. Lucas and Peter Calvacoresi. Introduction. Source gave clear warning that a counteroffensive was coming. He also gave warning, though at rather short notice, of when it was coming. He did not give by any means unmistakable indications of where it was coming, nor of its full scale.
They're also really aware of the hindsight aspect of the fact that nowadays we can look at all the evidence which they amassed and we know exactly what it means. But at the time, that wasn't the case. That's something they acknowledge as well.
To sum up, source made plain that a German offensive potential existed and gave hints as to the time and, less clearly, the place of the offensive. Viewed in the light of what has happened, these hints seem sufficiently plain, but the picture as it now appears is not the one which developed from day to day.
And Lucas and Calvacoresi also talk about the fact that there were so many strategic possibilities that could be seen in this intelligence.
There is here collected the evidence that pointed to a German offensive in the Ardennes. There is not much here of the evidence that pointed to German offensives elsewhere. Where there was a tangled wood of detail, there are now left standing only the few relevant trees. It is not easy to imagine how difficult it was then to find the way.
It's very poetic.
That is nice. I like that. It's kind of caressing.
They also identify the overdependence on ultra, which we've talked about earlier.
There is a risk of relying too much on source. His various successes in the past constitute a danger, if they lead to waiting for further information, because source will tell us that, or to doubting the likelihood of something happening because source would have told us that. The evidence given above was passed in its abundance to those responsible. But, in its very abundance, in its very authenticity, lie dangers. Source gave all he knew, but he does not always know everything.
And they also talk about the German secrecy and the deception efforts, because in hindsight, they could unravel a lot of these and work out what was really going on, see the clues that they hadn't picked up on the first time around.
The evidence has always tended to show that any such westward move would be in support of the army. But it has never been possible to infer the exact nature or timing of the army operation. We were tantalizingly near the truth, but the German camouflage of formations just sufficed its end.
So this report, I actually think, is a really fair summation of the situation. And for me as a researcher to be able to see a document like that in the archives, which sums up the whole picture, which contains, because they actually pick out all the individual messages, which were significant in hindsight, to be able to see a document like that is fascinating and incredibly helpful.
And this report's in the public domain now. It's at the National Archives. Anybody can read it now.
Yeah, it's in the National Archives. Anyone can read it. Its code is HW13/45.
Were there any of their conclusions within this assessment that particularly surprised you?
Not really. What surprised me was how spot on they were, because there are historians who wrote about the Ardennes intelligence failure who'd never read this report because it was classified until the early 2000s. But they come to very much the same conclusions. So I think it was interesting how well these two men understood the job they were doing and their place in it to be able to come to such sensible conclusions in such a short space of time.
Unless intelligence is perpetually ready to entertain all the alternatives, it sees only the evidence that favours the chosen view. And, unconsciously, other indications are not explained, but explained away.
And how did people at Bletchley Park respond to this report?
Well, I think they are very much willing to learn lessons. They're willing to be introspective. There isn't a backlash. There isn't an attempt to press this information or there's no cover-up or anything like that. What is interesting, we can also see in the documentation that's now released, is what happens when this report is sent further afield. Because within Bletchley Park, they accept its conclusions. But it's decided to actually send this report over to the States, to the American Joint Intelligence Committee in Washington. And it was going to be sent with a cover note by the British Director of Military Intelligence and the Head of Air Intelligence as well. That caused a bit of a ruckus, because the Director of Military Intelligence, in his note, he seemed to admit that the British intelligence services couldn't do their job properly. Mainly, he suggests, because there was too much intelligence and too much of a mass of information, and it was impossible for anyone to read it all. But crucially, he also says this must also be the situation in Washington, and that's never going to go down well with the Americans. And for very sensible diplomatic reasons, the head of MI6, Stuart Menzies, takes issue with this. And there is a certain amount of back and forth correspondence in the archives. In the end, the cover note which is sent is very much toned down from the original draft and designed not to admit fault to the Americans in such an obvious way and not to imply that the American intelligence services have also made mistakes.
But the controversy that can be caused by what seems to be quite an honest appraisal of things.
Yeah, it was just too honest to be released to our allies.
And now, news radio direct from Supreme Allied Headquarters. Charles Collingwood reporting.
As the German armies continue to retreat from the Ardennes salient, American troops have moved down from the north to cut the last main road leading out from the area the Germans are evacuating. This is the road from Houffalize to Saint-Vith, and we have cut it only 4 miles from the great road net of Houffalize itself. Of course, there are other minor roads leading out of the neck of the salient, but in the slippery, icy weather that prevails now, they will not support the traffic of the big road. Now is the critical time of the German retreat. Up until now, he's been able to move out in his own good time, and we've taken little toll of his retreating forces. But now we are narrowing in upon the Germans. We have cut their one good road. The German salient is withering like a winter's leaf. And the next few days are the ones in which we may be able to turn it to our advantage. The toll of dead and prisoners and equipment destroyed since the beginning is already very high. The enemy is now giving up most of the ground he won,
And before it is all over, it may turn out that we have hurt him worse than he hurt us.
So in the end, the Ardennes counteroffensive didn't achieve its aims. It did delay the Allied invasion of Germany. They weren't able to get going for a couple of months again. But actually, as General Bradley had predicted, it was to the Allies' advantage. It left the German forces greatly weakened. It meant their best troops were really a spent force, and it made the Allied defensives in the spring that much easier.
Are there any conclusions that we can draw in the present day from what took place in 1944-45?
Yeah, I think the problems that Bletchley Park and also the intelligence chiefs at the Allied commands were dealing with in 1944 are completely relevant to the present day. They had masses of information, but didn't know how to interpret it much of the time. They interpreted it in an overly optimistic way, which led them to make the wrong decisions. So even though Bletchley Park could provide very good intelligence, it was another question whether you could use it effectively. And there wasn't really one body which could bring all this intelligence together, read it all, and evaluate it effectively, and come to the right conclusions. What you had is lots of people working individually, finding pieces of the jigsaw, and never quite being able to put the whole jigsaw together. And I think that's exactly the sort of problems which face people doing intelligence work today.
I had a Belgian friend who we played hockey with. We were very keen hockey players. We had a mixed team and we played the Belgian team. And I got to know a family, the Conrad family. They had sawmills in the Ardennes. They were really worried to know whether their men were still alive and whether the mill was still there. So in the February, when the Battle of the Bulge finished, Pierre said to me, "Eileen, if you've got a day off, I'm driving there. Would you like to come?" We drove up to that area and we found that the mill was okay and the men were safe. Now, the snow that had been covering the whole of the area, because it was a very bad winter, was now melting. And as we approached the Ardennes, uncovered were the tanks, but also the dead bodies, the Germans, the French, the British, and mostly Americans, of course. And that was a horrific experience. Then we went into Bastogne, where a very big battle had taken place, and the town was devastated. That was a very chilling day, that trip.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.